This is Audible.
The Flatshare by Beth O'Leary.
Read by Carrie Hope Fletcher and Kwaku Fortune.
February. Chapter 1. Tiffy. You've got to say this for desperation. It makes you much more open-minded. I really can see some positives in this flat. The technicolour mould on the kitchen wall will scrub off, at least in the short term. The filthy mattress can be replaced fairly cheaply. And you could definitely make the argument that the mushrooms growing behind the toilet are introducing a fresh, outdoorsy feel to the place. Gertie and Mo, however, are not desperate, and they are not trying to be positive. I would describe their expressions as aghast. You can't live here. That's Gertie. She's standing with her heeled boots together and her elbows tucked in tightly, as though occupying as little space as possible in protest at being here at all. Her hair is pulled back in a low bun, already pinned so she can easily slip on the barrister's wig she wears for court. Her expression would be comical if it weren't my actual life we are discussing here. There must be somewhere else within budget, Tiff, Mo says worriedly, bobbing up from where he was examining the boiler cupboard. He looks even more dishevelled than usual, helped by the cobweb now hanging from his beard. This is even worse than the one we viewed last night. I look around for the estate agent. He's thankfully well out of earshot, smoking on the balcony. The sagging roof of the neighbour's garage, definitely not designed for walking on. I'm not looking around another one of these hellholes, Gertie says, glancing at her watch. It's 8 a.m. She'll need to be at Southwark Crown Court for 9. There must be another option. Surely we can fit her in at ours, Mo suggests for about the 5th time since Saturday. Honestly, would you stop with that? Gertie snaps. That is not a long-term solution, and she'd have to sleep standing up to even fit anywhere. She gives me an exasperated look. Couldn't you have been shorter? We could have put you under the dining table if you were less than 5'9". I make an apologetic face, but really I'd prefer to stay here than on the floor of the tiny, eye-wateringly expensive flat Mo and Gertie jointly invested in last month. They've never lived together before, even when we were at university. I'm concerned that it may well be the death of their friendship. Mo is messy, absent-minded, and has this uncanny ability to take up an enormous amount of room despite being relatively small. Gertie, on the other hand, has spent the last 3 years living in a preternaturally clean flat, so perfect that it looks computer-generated. I'm not sure how the two lifestyles will overlay without West London imploding. The main problem, though, is if I'm crashing on someone's floor, I can just as easily go back to Justin's place. And as of 11 p.m. Thursday, I have officially decided that I cannot be allowed that option any longer. I need to move forward, and I need to commit to somewhere so I can't go back. Mo rubs his forehead, sinking down into the grimy leather sofa. Tiff, I could lend you some. I don't want you to lend me any money, I say more sharply than I mean to. Look, I really need to get this sorted this week. It's this place or the flat share. The bed share, you mean, Gertie says. Can I ask why it has to be now? Not that I'm not delighted, just that last time I checked you were sitting tight in that flat waiting for the next time he who must not be named deigned to drop by. I wince, surprised. Not at the sentiment. Mo and Gertie never liked Justin, and I know they hate that I'm still living at his place, even though he's hardly ever there. It's just unusual to hear Gertie bring him up directly. After the final peacemaking dinner with the four of us ended in a furious row, I gave up on trying to make everyone get along and just stopped talking to Gertie and Mo about him altogether. Old habits die hard. Even post-breakup, we've all dodged around discussing him. And why does it have to be so cheap? Gertie goes on, ignoring the warning look from Mo. I know you're paid a pittance, but really, Tiffy, 400 a month is impossible in London. Have you actually thought about all this properly? I swallow. I can feel Mo watching me carefully. That's the trouble with having a counsellor as a friend. Mo is basically an accredited mind reader, and he never seems to switch his superpowers off. Tiff, he says gently. Oh, bloody hell, I'll just have to show them. There's nothing else for it. Quickly and all at once, that's the best way. Like pulling off a plaster, or getting into cold water, or telling my mother I broke something ornamental from the living room dresser. I reach for my phone and pull up the Facebook message. Tiffy, I'm really disappointed in how you acted last night. You were completely out of line. It's my flat, Tiffy. I can come by whenever I like with whoever I like. I would have expected you to be more grateful for letting you stay. I know us breaking up has been hard on you. I know you're not ready to leave. But if you think that means you can start trying to lay down some rules, then it's time you paid me for the past 3 months of rent. And you're going to need to pay full rent going forwards too. Patricia says you're taking advantage of me, living in my place pretty much for free. And even though I've always stood up for you with her, after yesterday's performance, I can't help thinking she might be right. Justin. Kiss, kiss. My stomach twists when I reread that line. You're taking advantage of me. Because I never intended to do that. I just didn't know that when he left, he really meant it this time. Mo finishes reading first. He popped in again on Thursday. With Patricia. I look away. He has a point. He's been really good to let me stay there this long. Funny, Gertie says darkly. I've always had the distinct impression he likes keeping you there. She makes it sound weird, but I sort of feel the same way. When I'm still in Justin's flat, it isn't really over. I mean, all the other times he's come back eventually. But then I met Patricia on Thursday. The real-life, extremely attractive, actually quite lovely woman Justin has left me for. There's never been another woman before. Mo reaches for my hand. Gertie takes the other. We stay like this, ignoring the estate agent smoking outside the window, and I let myself cry for a moment, just one fat tear down each cheek. So, anyway, I say brightly, withdrawing my hands to wipe my eyes, I need to move out. Now. Even if I wanted to stay and risk him bringing Patricia back again, I can't afford the rent, and I owe Justin a ton of money, and I really don't want to borrow from anyone. I'm kind of sick of not paying for things myself, to be honest. So, yes, it's this or the flat share. Mo and Gertie exchange a look. Gertie closes her eyes in pained resignation. Well, you clearly cannot live here. She opens her eyes and holds out a hand. Show me that advert again. I hand her my phone, flicking from Justin's message to the Gumtree ad for the flat share. Double bedroom in sunny one-bed Stockwell flat. Rent £350 per month, including bills. Available immediately for 6 months minimum. Flat and room/bed is to share with 27-year-old palliative care nurse who works nights and is away weekends. Only ever in the flat 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday. All yours the rest of the time. Perfect for someone with 9-to-5 job. To view, contact L Toomey. Details below. It's not just sharing a flat, Tiff, it's sharing a bed. Sharing a bed is odd, Mo says worriedly. What if this L Toomey is a man? Gertie asks. I'm prepared for this one. It doesn't matter, I say calmly. It's not like we'd ever be in the bed at the same time, or the flat even. This is uncomfortably close to what I said when justifying staying at Justin's place last month, but never mind. You'd be sleeping with him, Tiffany. Gertie says. Everyone knows the first rule of flat sharing is don't sleep with your flatmate. I don't think this sort of arrangement is what people are referring to, I tell her wryly. You see, Gertie, sometimes when people say sleeping together, what they really mean is... Gertie gives me a long, level look. Yes, thank you, Tiffany. Mo's sniggering stops abruptly when Gertie turns her glare on him. I'd say the first rule of flat sharing is to make sure you get on with the person before you move in. He says, cannily redirecting the glare to me again. Especially in these circumstances. Obviously I'll meet this L Toomey person first. If we don't get on, I won't take it. After a moment, Mo gives me a nod and squeezes my shoulder. We all descend into the kind of silence that comes after you've talked about something difficult. Half grateful for it being over, half relieved to have managed it at all. Fine, Gertie says. Fine, do what you need to do. It's got to be better than living in this kind of squalor. She marches out of the flat, turning at the last moment to address the estate agent as he steps through from the balcony. And you, she tells him loudly, are a curse upon society. He blinks as she slams the front door. There is a long, awkward pause. He stubs out the cigarette. You interested, then? He asks me. I get to work early and sink down in my chair. My desk is the closest thing to home at the moment. It's a haven of half-crafted objects, things that have proven too heavy to take back on the bus, and pot plants arranged in such a way that I can see people approaching before they can tell whether I'm at my desk. My pot plant wall is widely regarded among the other junior staff as an inspiring example of interior design. Really, it's just about choosing plants the same colour as your hair, in my case, red, and ducking slash running away when you catch sight of anyone moving purposefully. My first job of the day is to meet Catherine, one of my favourite authors. Catherine writes books about knitting and crochet. It's a niche audience that buys them, but that's the story of Butterfingers Press. We love a niche audience. We specialise in crafting and DIY books. Tie-dye bedsheets, design your own dresses, crochet yourself a lampshade, make all your furniture out of ladders, that sort of thing. I love working here. This is the only possible explanation for the fact that I've been assistant editor for 3.5 years, earning below the London living wage, and have made no attempt to rectify the situation by, say, applying for a job at a publishing house that actually makes money. Gertie likes to tell me that I lack ambition, but it really isn't that. I just love this stuff. As a child, I spent my days reading or tinkering with my toys until they suited me better, dip-dyeing Barbie's hair, pimping up my JCB truck. And now I read and craft for a living. Well, not really a living as such, but a bit of money. Just about enough to pay tax. I'm telling you, Tiffy, crochet is the next colouring books, Catherine tells me, once she's settled herself down in our best meeting room and talked me through the plan for her next book. I examine the finger she's waggling in my direction. She has about 50 rings on each hand, but I've yet to discern whether any of them are wedding or engagement rings. I imagine that if Catherine has any, she'll have more than one. Catherine is just on the acceptable side of eccentric. She has a straw blonde plait, one of those tans that somehow ages well, and endless stories of breaking into places in the 1960s and peeing on things. She was a real rebel once. She refuses to wear a bra, even to this day, when bras have become quite comfortable and women have mostly given up on fighting the power because Beyoncé is doing it for us. That'd be good, I say. Maybe we could add a strap line with the word mindful in it. It is quite mindful, isn't it? Or mindless. Catherine laughs, tipping her head back. Ugh, Tiffy, your job's ridiculous. She pats my hand affectionately and then reaches for her handbag. You see that Martin boy? She says. You tell him I'll only do that cruise day class if I have a glamorous young assistant. I groan. I know where this is going. Catherine likes to drag me along to these things. For any class, she needs a live model to show how to measure as you go when you're designing an outfit, apparently, and once I made the fatal error of offering myself up for the job when she couldn't find anyone. Now I am her go-to choice. PR is so desperate to get Catherine into these sorts of events that they've started begging me too. This is too far, Catherine. I'm not going on a cruise with you. But it's free. People pay thousands for those, Tiffy. You're only joining them for the Isle of Wight loop, I remind her. Martin has already briefed me on this one. And it's on a weekend. I don't work weekends. It's not work, Catherine insists, gathering her notes and packing them into her handbag in an entirely random order. It's a lovely Saturday sailing trip with one of your friends. She pauses. Me? She clarifies. We're friends, aren't we? I am your editor, I say, bundling her out of the meeting room. Think about it, Tiffy, she calls over her shoulder, unperturbed. She catches sight of Martin, who is already making a beeline for her from over by the printers. I'm not doing it unless she is, Martin, my boy. She's the one you need to talk to. And then she's gone, the grubby glass doors of our office swinging behind her. Martin turns on me. I like your shoes, he says with a charming smile. I shudder. I can't stand Martin from PR. He says things like, let's action that, in meetings and clicks his fingers at Ruby, who is a marketing exec, but who Martin seems to think is his personal assistant. He's only 23, but has decided it will further his merciless pursuit of seniority if he can seem older than he is, so he always puts on this awful jocular voice and tries to talk to our MD about golf. The shoes are excellent, though. They're purple Doc Martin-style boots with white lilies painted on them, and they took me most of Saturday. My crafting and customising is really up since Justin left me. Thanks, Martin, I say, already attempting to sidle back to the security of my desk. Leela mentioned that you're looking for somewhere to live, Martin says. I hesitate. I'm not sure where this is going. I sense nowhere good. Me and Hannah, a woman in marketing who always sneers at my fashion sense, have a spare room. You might have seen on Facebook, but I thought maybe I should bring it up, you know, IRL. It's a single bed, but, well, I guess that won't be a problem for you these days. As we're friends, Hannah and I decided we could offer it for £500 a month plus bills. That's so kind of you, I say, but I've actually just found somewhere. Well, I sort of have. Nearly. Oh, God, if El Toomey won't have me, will I have to live with Martin and Hannah? I mean, I already spend every working day with them, and frankly, that is plenty of Martin and Hannah time for me. I'm not sure my already shaky resolve to leave Justin's place can withstand the idea of Martin chasing me for rent payments and Hannah seeing me in my porridge-stained Adventure Time pyjamas every morning. Oh, right, well, we'll have to find someone else then. Martin's expression turns cunning. He has smelled guilt. You could make it up to me by going with Catherine to that... No! He gives an exaggerated sigh. God, Tiffy, it's a free cruise! Don't you go on cruises all the time? I used to go on cruises all the time when my wonderful and now ex-boyfriend used to take me on them. We'd sail from Caribbean island to Caribbean island in a sunny haze of romantic bliss. We'd explore European cities and then head back to the boat for incredible sex in our tiny little bunk. We'd stuff ourselves at the all-you-can-eat buffet and then lie out on the deck watching the gulls circle above us as we talked idly of our future children. Gone off them, I say, reaching for the phone. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to make a call.
Chapter 2. Leon. Phone rings as Dr. Patel is prescribing meds for Holly. Little girl with leukemia. Bad timing. Very bad timing. Dr. Patel not happy at interruption and makes her feelings clear. Seems to have forgotten that I too, as night nurse, should have gone home at 8 a.m. and yet I'm still here dealing with ill people and grouchy consultants like Dr. Patel. Hang up when it rings, obviously. Make mental note to listen to voicemail and change ringtone to something less embarrassing. This one is called Jive and is far too funky for hospice setting. Not that funk does not have role in place of sickness, just that is not always appropriate. Holly, why didn't you answer? Isn't that rude? What if it was your girlfriend with the short hair? Dr. Patel, what's rude is leaving your mobile on loud during a ward round. That I'm surprised whoever it was even tried ringing him at this hour. A glance at me, half irritable, half amused. Dr. Patel. You may have noticed that Leon is not a big talker, Holly. Leans in, conspiratorial. One of the registrars has a theory. He says that Leon has a limited number of words to use each shift, and when it gets to this time of day, he's entirely run out. Don't grace this with a response. Speaking of girlfriend with short hair, haven't told Kay about the room thing yet. Not had time. Also, I'm avoiding inevitable conflict. But really, must call her later this morning. Tonight was good. Mr. Pryor's pain lessened enough that he could start telling me about the man he fell in love with in the trenches. A dark-haired charmer called Johnny White, with the chiseled jaw of a Hollywood star and a twinkle in his eye. They had one fraught, romantic, war-torn summer, then were split up. Johnny White was taken to hospital for shell shock. They never saw each other again. Mr. Pryor could have gotten lots of trouble. Homosexuality vexing to military sorts. I was tired. Coffee buzzed, dying. But stayed with Mr. Pryor after handover. The man never gets visitors and loves to talk when he can. Failed to escape conversation without a scarf. My 14th from Mr. Pryor. Can only say no a certain number of times. And Mr. Pryor knits so fast, I wonder why anyone bothered with the Industrial Revolution. Pretty sure he's faster than the machine. Listened to voicemail after eating dangerously reheated chicken stir-fry in front of last week's MasterChef. Voicemail.
Hi, is that El Toomey? Oh, shite, you can't answer. I always do this on voicemails. Okay, I'm just going to proceed on the assumption that you're El Toomey. My name's Tiffy Moore, and I'm ringing about the gum triad, about a room. Look, my friends think it's weird that we'd be sharing a bed, even though it'd be at different times, but it doesn't bother me if it doesn't bother you, and to be honest, I'd do pretty much anything for a central London flat I can move into right away at that price. Oh, God, not anything. There's loads of things I wouldn't do. I'm not like... No, Martin, not now. Can't you see him on the phone?
Who was Martin? A child? Does this rambly woman with Essex accent want to bring a child into my flat? Voicemail continues.
Sorry, that's my colleague. He wants me to go on a cruise with a middle-aged lady to talk to pensioners about crochet.
Not the explanation I was expecting. Better, definitely, but begs many questions. Voicemail continues.
Look, just call me back or text me if the room's still available. I'm super tidy, I'll keep right out of your way, and I'm still in the habit of cooking double quantities of my dinner. So, if you like home-cooked food, I can leave leftovers.
She reads out her number. Just in time, I remember to jot it down. Woman is annoying, definitely, and is female, which may vex Kay. But only two other people have called. One asked if I had a problem with pet hedgehogs. Answer, not unless they're living in my flat. And another one was definitely a drug dealer. Not being judgmental, was offered drugs during call. I need £350 extra a month if I'm going to keep paying Sal without Kay's help. This is the only available plan. Plus, we'll never actually see annoying woman. We'll only ever be in when annoying woman is out. I text her. Hi there, Tiffy. Thanks for your voicemail. Would be great to meet you and talk about the arrangements for my flat. How is Saturday morning? Cheers. Leon Toomey. Nice, normal person message. Resist all urges to ask about Martin's cruise ship plan. They'll find myself curious. She replies almost instantly. Hi. Sounds great. 10 a.m. at the flat itself, then. Kiss. Let's make it 9 a.m, or I'll fall asleep. See you then. Dress is on the ad. Cheers, Leon. There. Done. Easy £350 a month, almost in the bag already. Now to tell Kay.
Chapter 3. So, naturally, I get curious and Google him. Leon Toomey is a pretty unusual name, and I find him on Facebook without having to employ the creepy stalker techniques I reserve for new writers I'm trying to poach from other publishing houses. It's a relief to see that he's not my type at all, which will definitely simplify things. If Justin did ever meet Leon, for instance, I don't think he'd see him as a threat. He's got light brown skin and thick, curly hair long enough to be pushed back behind his ears, and he's way too gangly for me. All elbows and neck, you know the type. He looks like a nice guy, though. In every photo, he's doing this sweet, lopsided smile that doesn't seem at all creepy or murderous, though actually, if you look at a picture with that idea in mind, everyone starts to look like an axe-wielding killer, so I try to put the thought out of my head. He looks friendly and unthreatening. These are good things. However, I do know unequivocally that he is a man. Am I actually willing to share a bed with a man? Even sharing a bed with Justin was a bit horrible sometimes, and we were in a relationship. His side of the mattress sagged in the middle, and he didn't always shower in between getting home from the gym and going to bed, so there was a sort of sweaty smell to his bit of the duvet. I always had to make extra sure it was the same way up, so I didn't get the sweaty side. But still, £350 per month. And he would never actually be there. Tiffany! My head shoots up. Crap, that's Rachel, and I know what she wants. She wants the manuscript for this bloody Make a Stir, Bake and Make book that I've been ignoring all day. Don't try sneaking off to the kitchen or pretending to be on the phone, she says from over my wall of pot plants. This is the trouble with having friends at work. You drunkenly tell them your tricks when the two of you go to the pub and then you're defenceless. You've had your hair done, I say. It's a desperate ploy to redirect the conversation early. But her hair is especially cool today. It's in braids, as always, but this time the tiny plaits of bright turquoise ribbon laced between them like corset strings. How do you braid it like that? Don't try to distract me with my mastermind specialist subject, Tiffany Moore, Rachel says, tapping her perfectly polka-dotted nails. When am I getting that manuscript? I just need a little longer. I put my hand over the papers in front of me so she can't see the page numbers, which are in the single digits. She narrows her eyes. Thursday? I nod eagerly. Yeah, why not? I mean, that's totally unachievable at this point, but Friday sounds a lot better when you're saying it on Thursday, so I'll just tell her then. And go for a drink with me tomorrow night? I pause. I was meant to be good and not spend any money this week on account of the looming debt, but nights out with Rachel are always brilliant, and frankly, I could really do with having some fun. Besides, she won't be able to argue with me about this manuscript on Thursday if she's hungover. Done. Drunk man number one is the expressive kind. The sort of drunk who likes to throw his arms out wide regardless of what might be directly to his left or right. So far, that's included one large fake palm tree, one tray of sambuca shots, and one relatively famous Ukrainian model. Every movement is exaggerated, even the basic walking steps. You know, left foot out in front, right foot out, repeat. Drunk man number one makes walking look like the hokey cokey. Drunk man number two is the deceitful sort. He keeps his face very still when he's listening to you, as though the absence of expression will make it clear how very sober he is. He nods occasionally, and fairly convincingly, but doesn't quite blink enough. His attempts to stare at your boobs are much less subtle than he thinks they are. I wonder what they think of me and Rachel. They headed straight for us, but that's not conclusively positive. Back when I was with Justin, if I was going out clubbing with Rachel, he would always remind me that lots of men see quirky girl and think desperate and easy. He's right, as per usual. I actually wonder if it's easier to get laid as a quirky girl than a perky cheerleader type. You're more approachable and nobody assumes you've already got a boyfriend. Which is probably another reason Justin wasn't a fan of my nights out with Rachel on reflection. So, like, books about how to make cakes, says drunk man number two, thus proving his listening skills and aforementioned sobriety. Honestly, what's the point in having sambuca shots if you're just going to pretend you haven't been drinking all night? Yeah, Rachel says. Or build shelves or make clothes or what do you like to do? She is drunk enough to find drunk man number two attractive, but I suspect she's just trying to keep him busy to open the floor for me to jump drunk man number one. Of the two, drunk man number one is clearly preferable. He is tall enough for starters. This is the first challenge. I'm 6 foot, and though I have no problem with dating shorter men, it often seems to bother guys if I'm more than an inch or two taller than them. And that's fine by me. I've no interest in the ones who care about that sort of thing. It's a useful filter. What do I like to do? Repeats drunk man number two. I like to dance with beautiful women at bars with bad names and overpriced drinks. He flashes a sudden grin, which, though a little more sluggish and wonky than it's probably intended to be, it's actually quite attractive. I can see Rachel is thinking the same. She shoots me a calculating look. Not so drunk as all that, then. And I can see her evaluating the situation between me and drunk man number one. I look at drunk man number one too and do some evaluating of my own. He's tall, with nice broad shoulders and hair that's greying at the temples in a way that's actually quite sexy. He's probably mid-30s. He could be a little 1990s Clooney-ish if you squinted a bit or dimmed the lights. Do I fancy him? If I do, I could sleep with him. You can do that when you're single. Weird. I've not thought about sleeping with anyone since Justin. You get tons of time back when you're single and not having sex. Not just the actual time doing it, but the time shaving legs, buying nice underwear, wondering whether all other women get bikini waxes, etc. It's a real plus. Of course, there's the overwhelming absence of one of the greatest aspects of your adult life, but you do get much more admin done. Obviously, I know that we broke up 3 months ago. I know that in theory, I can have sex with other people, but I can't help thinking about what Justin would say. How angry he'd be. I may be technically allowed, but I'm not, you know, allowed. Not in my head, not yet. Rachel gets it. Sorry, mate, she says, patting drunk man number two on the arm. I like to dance with my friend. She scribbles her number on a napkin. God knows where she got that pen from. The woman's a magician. And then my hand is in hers, and we're winding our way into the centre of the dance floor where the music hits my skull from both sides, sending my eardrums shivering. What kind of drunk are you? Rachel asks as we grind inappropriately to classic Destiny's Child. I'm a bit... thoughtful, I shout at her. Too analytical to sleep with that nice man. She reaches for a drink from the tray of one of those shot ladies who wanders around asking you to overpay for things and hands the woman some cash. Not enough sort of drunk then, she says, giving me the drink. You may be an editor, but no drunk girl trots out the word analytical. Assistant editor, I remind her and knock back the drink. Jägerbomb. It's strange how something so fundamentally disgusting, whose very aftertaste makes you want to vomit the next day, can taste delicious on a dance floor. Rachel plies me with drink all night and flirts with every wingman in sight, chucking all attractive men in my direction. Whatever she says, I'm plenty tipsy enough, so I don't think much of it. She's just being an excellent friend. The night spins by in a mass of dances and brightly coloured drinks. It is only when Mo and Gertie arrive that I start to wonder what this night is all about. Mo has the look of a man who was summoned on short notice. His beard is a little skew-iff, like he slept on it funny, and he's in a worn-out t-shirt I think I remember from uni, though it's a little tighter on him now. Gertie looks haughtily beautiful as usual, with no makeup on and her hair yanked up in a ballerina topknot. It's hard to tell if she was planning to come because she never wears makeup and dresses impeccably all the time anyway. She could well have just pulled on a slightly higher pair of heels to go with her skinny jeans last minute. They're making their way across the dance floor. My suspicion that Mo was not planning to be here is confirmed. He's not dancing. Take Mo to a club and there will always be dancing. So why have they turned up on my random Wednesday night out with Rachel? They don't even know her that well, only through the odd birthday drinks or housewarming parties. In fact, Gertie and Rachel have a low-level alpha-wolf feud going on, and when we do all get together, they usually end up bickering. Is it my birthday? I drunkenly wonder. Do I have exciting surprise news? I turn to Rachel. What? Table, she says, pointing at the booths at the back of the club. Gertie does a relatively good job of hiding her irritation at being redirected just when she's battled her way through to the centre of the dance floor. I'm getting bad vibes. I'm just at the happiest point of drunk, though, so I'm willing to suspend worried thoughts in the hope that they're coming to tell me that I've won a 4-week holiday to New Zealand or something. But no. Tiffy, I didn't know how to tell you this, Rachel is saying, so this was the best plan I could come up with. Get you happy drunk, remind you what flirting feels like, then call your support team. She reaches to take both my hands. Tiffy, Justin is engaged.
Chapter 4. Conversation regarding flat not at all as predicted. Kay was unusually angry. Seemed upset at idea of someone else sleeping in my bed besides her. But she never comes round. Hates the dark green walls and elderly neighbours. Is part of her, you spend too much time with old people thing. We're always at hers, like grey walls, cool young neighbours. Argument ends at weary impasse. She wants me to pull down and cancel Essex Woman. I'm not changing my mind. It's the best idea for getting easy cash every month that I've ever thought of. Bar lottery winning, which cannot be factored into financial planning. Didn't want to go back to borrowing that £350. Kay was the one who said it. It wasn't good for our relationship. She's come that far, so she'll come around. Slow night. Holly couldn't sleep. We played checkers. She lifts her fingers and dances them over the board like she's weaving a magic spell before she touches a counter. Apparently it's a mind game. Makes the other player watch where you're going instead of planning their next move. Where did a 7-year-old learn mind games? Asked the question. You're quite naive, Leon, aren't you? She means naive. Probably never said it out loud before. Just read it in one of her books. I'm very worldly wise, thank you, Holly. Gives me patronising look. It's okay, Leon. You're just too nice. I bet people walk all over you like a doormat. She picked that up from somewhere, definitely. Probably her father, who visits every other week in a sharp grey suit, bringing poorly chosen sweets and sour smell of cigarette smoke. I say, being nice is a good thing. You can be strong and nice. You don't have to be one or the other. The patronising look again. Look, it's like how Kay's strong, you're nice. She spreads her hands like it's the way of the world. I'm startled. Didn't know she knew Kay's name. Richie rings just as I get in. Have to sprint to get to the landline. I know it'll be him, it only ever is. And hit head on low-hanging pendant light in kitchen. Least favourite thing about excellent flat. Rub head, close eyes. Listen closely to Richie's voice for tremors and clues to how he really is, and just for hearing a real, living, breathing, still okay Richie.
Tell me a good story.
Close eyes tighter. It's not been a good weekend for him then. Weekends are bad. They're banged up for longer. I can tell he's down from that accent so peculiar to the two of us. Always part London, part County Cork. It's more Irish when he's sad. I tell him about Holly. Her checkers skills. Her accusations of naivety. Richie listens and then...
She going to die.
It's difficult. People struggle to see it's not about whether she's going to die. Palliative care isn't just a place you go to slowly slip away. More people live and leave than die in our wards. It's about being comfortable for the duration of something necessary and painful. Making bad times easier. Holly, though, she might die. She is very sick. Lovely, precocious, and very sick. I say, leukemia statistics are pretty good for kids her age.
I don't want statistics, man. I want a good story.
I smile, reminded of when we were kids, acting out the plot of Neighbours in the month when the TV broke. Richie's always liked a good story. I say, she'll be fine. She'll grow up to be a coder, professional coder, using all her checker skills to develop new digitally generated food that'll stop anyone going hungry and put Bono out of work around Christmas times. Richie laughs. Not much of one, but enough to ease the worried knot in my stomach. Silence for a while. Companionable, maybe, or just an absence of suitably expressive words.
Tell in here, man.
The words hit like a punch in the gut. Too often this last year I've felt that connection in my stomach like a bunched fist. Always at times like this, when reality hits afresh after days of blocking it out. I say, appeal's not far off. We're getting there. Sal says...
Hey, Sal says he wants pain. I know the score, Lee. It can't be done.
Voice heavy, slow, almost slurred. I say, what is this? What, have you lost faith in your big brother? He used to tell me I'd be a billionaire. I hear a reluctant smile.
You've given enough.
Never. That's impossible. I will never give enough. Not for this, though I've wished enough times that I could just have swapped places to save him from it. I say, I've got a scheme, a money-making scheme. You're going to love it. Scuffle.
Hey, man, give me one sec.
Muffled voices. My heart beats faster. When on the phone to him, it's easy to think he is somewhere safe and quiet, with only his voice and mine. But there he is, in the yard, with a queue behind him, having made the choice between using this half hour out of his prison cell to make a phone call or to have his only shot at a shower.
Got to go, Lee. Love you.
Dial tone. 8:30 on Saturday. Even leaving now, I'll be late. And I'm not leaving now, evidently. I'm changing dirty sheets on dorsal ward, according to Dr. Patel. According to ward nurse on Coral Ward, I'm taking blood from Mr. Pryor. According to Socia, the junior doctor, I'm helping her with the patient dying on Kelp Ward. Socia wins. Call Kay as I run. Kay, on picking up.
You're stuck at work, aren't you?
Too out of breath for proper explanation. Ward's too far apart for emergency situations. Hospice Board of Trustees should invest in shorter corridors.
It's okay. I'll meet that girl for you.
Stumble. Surprised. I'd planned to ask, obviously. That's why I called Kay and not Essex woman herself to cancel. But was very easy.
Look, I don't like this flat sharing plan. But I know you need the money and I get it. However, if I'm going to feel okay about this, I think everything should go through me. I'll meet this divvy person. I'll handle the arrangements. And that way the random woman sleeping in your bed isn't someone that you actually interact with. Then I don't feel quite as weird about it. And you don't have to deal with it, which, let's be honest, you do not have time to do.
Pang of love. Could be Stitch, of course. Hard to be sure at this stage of relationship, but still. You sure?
Yes, this is the plan. And no working weekends, okay? Weekends are for me.
Seems fair. Thanks. Thank you. And would you mind tell her...
Yep. Tell her about the weird guy in flat 5 and warn her about the foxes.
Definite love pang.
I know you think I don't listen, but I actually do.
Still a good minute's running before I reach Kelp Ward. I've not paced self adequately. Rookie mistake. I'm thrown by the horrible nowness of this shift, with all its dying people and bed sores and tricksy dementia patients, and I'm forgetting basic rules of surviving in hospice setting. Jog, don't run. Always know the time. Never lose your pen.
Leon.
Forgot about talking out loud. It was just heavy breathing. Probably quite sinister. Thanks. Love you.
Chapter 5. I consider wearing sunglasses, but decide that would make me look like a bit of a diva given that it's February. Nobody wants a diva as a flatmate. The question, of course, is whether they want a diva more or less than they want an emotional wreck of a woman who has clearly spent the last 2 days weeping. I remind myself that this is not a flatmate situation. Leon and I don't need to get on. We're not going to be living together, not really. We're just going to be occupying the same space at different times. It's no bother to him if I happen to spend all my free time weeping, is it? Jacket, Rachel commands, handing it over. I have not yet reached the depths of needing someone else to dress me, but Rachel stayed over last night, and if Rachel's here, she's probably going to take charge of the situation, even if the situation is me getting my clothes on in the morning. Too broken to protest, I take the jacket and slip it on. I do love this jacket. I made it out of a giant ball dress I found in a charity shop. I just picked the whole thing apart and used the fabric from scratch, but left the beading wherever it fell, so now there's purple sequins and embroidery across the right shoulder, down the back, and under my boobs. It looks a bit like a circus master's jacket, but fits perfectly, and oddly, the underboob beading is really flattering to the waistline. "Didn't I give this to you?" I say, frowning. "Last year sometime." "You part with that jacket?" Rachel makes a face. "I know you love me, but I'm pretty sure you don't love anyone that much." "Right. Of course. I'm such a mess I can hardly think straight. At least I actually care about what I'm wearing this morning, though. You know things are bad when I'll throw on whatever's top in the drawer. And it's not like other people won't notice it. My wardrobe is such that an insufficiently planned outfit will really show. Thursday's mustard yellow cords, cream-frilled blouse and long green cardigan caused a bit of a stir at work. Hannah in marketing had a full-blown coughing fit when I walked into the kitchen as she was mid-gulp of coffee. On top of that, nobody gets why I'm suddenly so upset. I can see them all thinking, what's she crying about now? Didn't Justin leave months ago? They're right. I have no idea why this particular stage of Justin's new relationship bothers me so much. I'd already decided I was going to move out properly this time. And it's not like I wanted him to marry me or anything. I just thought... he'd come back. That's what's always happened before. He goes off, doors slam, he freezes me out, ignores my calls, but then realises his mistake, and just when I think I'm ready to start getting over him, there he is again, holding out his hand and telling me to come with him on some kind of amazing adventure. But this is it, isn't it? He's getting married. This is... Rachel wordlessly passes me the tissues. I'll have to redo my makeup again, I say once the worst of it is over. Really not got time, Rachel says, flashing me her phone screen. Shit, 8:30. I need to leave now or I'm going to be late, and that will look bad. If we're going to observe strict who's in the flat when rules, Leon's going to want me to be able to tell the time. Sunglasses? I ask. Sunglasses, Rachel hands them over. I grab my bag and head for the door. As the train rattles its way through the tunnels of the Northern Line, I catch sight of my reflection in the window and straighten up a little. I look good. The blurry scratched glass helps, sort of like an Instagram filter. But this is one of my favourite outfits. My hair is newly washed and coppery red, and though I may have cried away all my eyeliner, my lipstick is still intact. Here I am. I can do this. I can manage just fine on my own. It sticks for about as long as it takes to get to the entrance to Stockwell Station. Then a guy in a car screams, "Get your fanny out!" at me, and the shock is enough to set me spiralling back into shit-at-life post-breakup tiffy again. I'm too upset even to point out the anatomical issues I'd have if I tried to comply with his request. I reach the right block of flats in 5 minutes or so. It's a good distance to the station. At the prospect of actually finding my future home, I wipe my cheeks dry and take a proper look at the place. It's one of those squat brick blocks, and out the front there's a small courtyard with a bit of sad-looking London-style grass that's more like well-mown hay. There are parking spaces for each flat's tenants, one of whom seems to be using their space to store a bewildering number of empty banana crates. As I buzz for flat 3, a movement catches my eye. It's a fox, strolling out from around where the bins seem to live. It gives me an insolent stare, pausing with one paw in the air. I've never actually been this close to a fox before. It's a lot mangier than they look in picture books. Foxes are nice, though, aren't they? They're so nice you're not allowed to shoot them for fun anymore, even if you're an aristocrat with a horse. The door buzzes and clicks out of the lock. I make my way inside. It's very brown. Brown carpet, biscuit-coloured walls. But that doesn't really matter. It's the inside of the flat that matters. When I knock on the door of flat 3, I find myself feeling genuinely nervous. No, borderline panicked. I'm really doing this, aren't I? Considering sleeping in some random stranger's bed. Actually leaving Justin's flat. Oh, God. Maybe Gertie was right and this is all just a bit too much. For a vertiginous moment, I imagine going back to Justin's, back to the comfort of that chrome and white flat, to the possibility of having him back. But the thought doesn't feel quite as good as I imagined it would. Somehow, perhaps around 11 p.m. the Thursday before last, that flat started to look a little different, and so did I. I know in a vague, don't look straight at it sort of way that this is a good thing. I've got this far. I can't let myself go back now. I need to like this place. It's my only option. So when someone answers the door who clearly isn't Leon, I'm so in the mood to be accommodating that I just go with it. I don't even act surprised. Hi! Hello, says the woman at the door. She's petite, with olive skin and one of those pixie haircuts that makes you look French if you've got a small enough head. I immediately feel enormous. She does nothing to dispel this feeling. As I step into the flat, I can feel her looking me up and down. I try to take in the decor. Ooh, dark green wallpaper. Looks genuine 1970s. But after a while, the feel of her eyes on me starts to nag. I turn to meet her gaze head on. Oh, it's the girlfriend. And her expression could not be more obvious. It says, I was worried you might be hot and try to steal my boyfriend from me while you make yourself at home in his bed. But now I've seen you and he'd never be attracted to you, so yes, come in. She's all smiles now. Fine. Whatever. If this is what it takes to get this flat, no problem. She's not going to belittle me out of this one. She has no idea how desperate I am. I'm Kay, she says, holding out a hand. Her grip is firm. Leon's girlfriend. I figured. I smile to take the edge off it. So nice to meet you. Is Leon in the... I lean my head into the bedroom. It's that, or the living room, which has the kitchen in the corner. There's not really much more to the flat than this. Bathroom? I try on seeing the empty bedroom. Leon's stuck at work, says Kay, ushering me through to the living area. It's pretty minimalist, and a little worn around the edges, but it's clean, and I do love that 1970s wallpaper everywhere. I bet someone would pay £80 a roll for that if Farrow and Ball started selling it. There's a low-hanging pendant light in the kitchen area that doesn't quite match the decor, but is sort of fabulous. The sofa is battered leather, the TV isn't actually plugged in but looks relatively decent, and the carpet has been recently hoovered. This all looks promising. Maybe this is going to be good. Maybe it's going to be great. I flip through a quick montage of myself here, lazing about on the sofa, rustling something up in the kitchen, and suddenly the idea of having all this space to myself makes me want to bounce on the spot. I rein myself in just in time. Kay does not strike me as the spontaneous dancing sort. So will I not meet Leon? I ask, remembering Mo's first rule of flat sharing with a wince. Well, I suppose you might do eventually, Kay says. But it'll be me you speak to. I'm handling renting the place out for him. You'll never be in at the same time. The flat will be yours from 6 in the evening until 8 in the morning in the week, and over the whole weekend. It's a 6-month agreement for now. Is that okay with you? Yeah, that's just what I need. I pause. And Leon won't ever pop in unexpectedly? Out of his hours or anything? Absolutely not, Kay says with the air of a woman who plans to make sure of it. From 6 p.m. until 8 a.m, the flat is yours and yours alone. Great. I breathe out slowly, quieting the flutter of excitement in my stomach, and check the bathroom. You can always tell a place by its bathroom. All the appliances are clean, bright white. There's a dark blue shower curtain, a few tidy bottles of mysterious, manly-looking creams and liquids, and a scuffed but serviceable mirror. Excellent. I'll take it, if you'll have me. I feel certain that she'll say yes if it really is her decision to make. I knew it as soon as she gave me that look in the hallway. Whatever Leon's criteria for a flatmate, Kay just has the one, and I've clearly ticked the suitably unattractive box. Wonderful, Kay says. I'll call Leon and let him know.
Chapter 6. Kay calls me.
She's ideal.
I'm doing slow blinking on the bus. Delicious slow blinks, which are really just short naps. Really? Not annoying.
Does that matter? She'll be clean and tidy and she can move in immediately. If you're really determined to do this, then you can't expect much better than that.
She wasn't bothered by the weird man living in flat 5, or the Fox family. Slight pause.
She didn't mention either being a problem.
Delicious slow blink. Really long one. Got to be careful. Can't face waking up at the end of the bus route and having to come all the way back in again. Always a danger after a long week. What's she like then?
She's quirky. Larger than life. She's wearing these big horn-rimmed sunglasses, even though it's basically still winter, and had painted flowers all over her boots. But the point is that she's skint and happy to find a room this cheap.
Larger than life is K-speak for overweight. Wish she wouldn't say things like that.
Look, you're on your way, aren't you? We can talk about it when you get here.
My plan for arrival was to greet Kay with customary kiss, remove work clothes, drink water, fall into Kay's bed, sleep for all eternity. I say, maybe tonight, when I've slept. Silence. Deeply irritated silence. I'm an expert at Kay silences. Kay says,
so you're just going to go straight to bed when you get in?
Bite tongue. Resist urge to give blow-by-blow account of my week. I say, I can stay up if you want to talk.
No. You need your sleep.
I'm clearly staying up. Best make the most of these blink naps until bus gets to Islington. Frosty welcome from Kay. Make mistake of mentioning Richie, which turns temperature dial down even further. My fault, probably. Just can't talk to her about him without hearing the argument. Like she hits replay every time she says Richie's name. As she busies herself cooking Brinner, combination of breakfast and dinner, suitable for boat night and day dwellers, tell myself on repeat that I should remember how the argument ended. That she said sorry. Kay says, so, are you going to ask me about weekends? Stare at her, slow to answer. Sometimes find it hard to talk after a long night. Just opening my mouth to form comprehensible thoughts is like lifting a very heavy thing, or like one of those dreams where you need to run but your legs are moving through treacle. Ask you what? Kay pauses, omelette pan in hand. She's very pretty against wintry sunlight through kitchen window. The weekends? Where were you planning to stay? With Tiffy in your flat? Oh, I see. Hoped I would stay here. As I'm here every weekend, I'm not working anyway. Kay smiles. Get that satisfying feeling of having said the right thing, followed quickly by a squeeze of anxiety. I know you're planning on staying here, you know. I just wanted to hear you say it. She sees my bemused expression. Normally you're just here on weekends by coincidence, not because you've planned for it, not because it's our life plan. Word plan is much less pleasant with life in front of it. Suddenly very busy eating omelette. Kay squeezes my shoulder, runs her fingers up and down the back of my neck, tugs my hair. Thank you. I feel guilty, though I haven't exactly misled her. I did assume I'd be here every weekend, did factor that into plan with renting out room, just didn't think about it that way. The life plan way. 2 in the morning. When I first joined the hospice nights team, nights coming off shift seemed useless, would sit awake, wishing for sunlight. But now this is my time, the muffled quiet, the rest of London sleeping or getting very drunk. I'm taking every locum night shift the hospice rota coordinator will give me. They're the highest paid, excluding weekend nights, which I've told Kay I won't take. Plus, it's the only way this flat chair plan will work. Not sure it'll even be worth recalibrating for weekends now. We'll work 5 and 7 nights. Might just stay nocturnal. Generally use this 2 a.m. time to write to Richie. His phone calls are limited, but he can receive as many letters as I can send him. It's been 3 months as of last Tuesday since he was sentenced. Hard to know how to mark an anniversary like that. Raising a glass? Striking another tally on the wall? Richie took it well, considering. But when he went in, Sal had told him he'd have him out of there by February. So this one was especially bad. Sal. He's trying his best, presumably. But Richie is innocent and in prison, so can't help but feel a little resentful towards his lawyer. Sal isn't bad. Uses big words, carries a briefcase, never doubts himself. All seem classic reassuring lawyer things. But mistakes keep happening, like unexpected guilty verdicts. What are our options, though? No other lawyer is sufficiently interested to take Richie on for a reduced fee. No other lawyer is familiar with his case. No other lawyer is already all set up to speak to Richie in prison. No time to find someone new. Every day that goes by, Richie sinks further away. Has to be me that deals with Sal all the time too, never ma'am. Which means endless exhausting phone calls chasing him. But ma'am is shouty and blamey. Sal is sensitive, easily put off from actually working on Richie's case, and completely indispensable. This is doing me no good. 2 a.m. is terrible time for dwelling on legal issues. Worst of all the times. If midnight is witching hour, 2 a.m. is dwelling hour. Idly reaching for distraction, I find myself Googling Johnny White. Mr. Pryor's Hollywood-jawed long-lost love. There are many Johnny Whites. One is a leading figure in Canadian dance music. Another is an American footballer. Both were definitely not around during World War II, falling in love with charming English gentlemen. Still, internet was made for situations like this, no? Try Johnny White war casualties, then hate myself a bit. Feels like betraying Mr. Pryor to assume Johnny's dead. But it's worth trying to eliminate those options first. Find a website called Find War Dead. I'm initially slightly horrified, but decide, actually, it's amazing. Everyone's remembered here. Like digital, searchable tombstones. I can search by name, regiment, which war, dates of birth. I type in Johnny White and specify World War II, but don't have any more to give them. 78 Johnny Whites died in armed forces in World War II. Sit back, stare at the list of names. John K. White, James Dudley Jonathan White, John White, John George White, John or L. White, Jonathan Reginald White, John... All right. Feel suddenly overwhelmingly sure that Mr. Pryor's lovely Johnny White is dead, and wish there was a similar database for those who fought but did not die in the war. That would be nice. A survivor's list. Struck as one is at 2 a.m. by the horror of humanity and its inclination of terrible acts of mass murder. Kay calls. Leon, your bleep is going in my ear. Leave laptop on sofa after hitting print and then open bedroom door to find Kay lying on side, duvet overhead, one arm up in the air holding my bleep. Grab bleep. Grab phone. I'm not working, of course, but the team wouldn't bleep me if it wasn't important. Socia, junior doctor.
Leon, it's Holly.
I'm pulling on shoes. I say, how bad? Keys. Keys. Where are keys? Socia.
She's got an infection. Obs are not looking good. She's asking for you. I don't know what to do, Leon. And Dr. Patel isn't answering a bleep. And the reg is skiing. And June couldn't get cover organised, so there's nobody else to call.
Located keys in bottom of washing basket. Inspired place to keep them. heading for the door. Sosha talking white blood cell counts in my ear, shoelaces flapping. Kay calls, Leon, you're still wearing your pyjamas. Damn, thought I'd managed to get to the front door faster than usual.
Chapter 7. Okay, so the new flat's quite full. Cozy. Cluttered, Gertie confirms, standing in about the only unoccupied space in the bedroom. It's cluttered. You know my style is eclectic, I protest, straightening up the adorable tie-dye bed throw I found at Brixton Market last summer. I'm trying very hard to keep my positive face on. Packing up and leaving Justin's flat was awful, and the drive here took 4 times as long as Google said it would, and carrying everything up the stairs was torture. Then I had to hold a long conversation with Kay as she gave me the keys, when all I wanted to do was sit down somewhere and gently dab at my hairline until I stopped panting. It has not been a fun day. Did you discuss this with Leon? Mo asks, perching on the edge of the bed. I mean, bringing all your stuff. I frown. Of course I would be bringing all my stuff. Did that need discussing? I'm moving in. That means my stuff has to live here with me. Where else would it live? This is my permanent abode. However, I am now very aware that my bedroom is shared with another person, and that that person has their own stuff, which was, up until this weekend, occupying most of this room. It's been a bit of a squeeze getting everything in. I've solved a few problems by moving things into other parts of the house. Lots of my candle holders are living on the edge of the bath now, for instance, and my amazing lava lamp has a great spot in the living area. But all the same, I could do with Leon having a bit of a clear out. He should probably have done that beforehand, really. It was the decent thing, given that I was moving in. Perhaps I should have taken some of my things to my parents' house, but most of this stuff lived in storage at Justin's, and it had felt so good to dig it all out last night. Rachel joked that when I found the lava lamp, it was like Andy being reunited with Woody in Toy Story, but to be honest, it had been surprisingly emotional. I'd sat for a while in the hall, staring at the multicoloured mess of my favourite things spilling out from the cupboard under the stairs, and felt for a weird moment that if the cushions could breathe again, so could I. My phone rings. It's Catherine. She's the only writer I'd pick up the phone to on a Saturday, mainly because she's probably ringing me about something hilarious she's done, like tweeting a wildly inappropriate picture of herself from the 80s with a now very important politician, or dip-dyeing her elderly mother's hair.
How's my favourite editor?
She asks when I pick up. All moved into my new home, I tell her, gesturing for Mo to put the kettle on. He looks mildly peeved, but does so all the same.
Perfect. Brilliant. What are you doing Wednesday?
Catherine asks. Just work, I tell her, mentally scanning my diary. Actually, I have a tedious meeting on Wednesday with our Director of International Book Rights to talk about the new book I commissioned last summer from a debut bricklayer-turned-trendy designer. It's her job to sell it abroad. When I acquired it, I talked a lot, but really quite vaguely, about his international social media presence, which, as it happens, is rather a lot smaller than I made it out to be. She's always emailing for more detail and specific breakdowns of reach by territory. It's getting to the point where I can't avoid her any longer, even with my wall of stealthy pot plants.
Great,
says Catherine, who is being suspiciously enthusiastic.
I have some really good news for you.
Oh, yes? I'm hoping for early manuscript delivery or a sudden change of heart about the chapter on hats and scarves. She's been threatening to remove it, which would be disastrous, as that's the only part that makes the book remotely sellable.
The Sea Breeze Away people rescheduled my live How to Crochet Your Own Clothes Fast show to their Wednesday cruise last minute, so you can help me with the cruise after all.
This time it would be in work hours, and would put off that conversation with the rights director for at least another week. What would I prefer? Getting dressed in homemade crochet waistcoats on a cruise ship with Catherine? Or getting bollocked by the rights director in a meeting room with no windows? All right, I'll do it.
Honestly?
Honestly, I say, accepting Mo's tea. I'm not doing any talking, though. And you're not allowed to manhandle me as much as you did last time. I had bruises for days.
The trials and tribulations of life as a model, eh, Tiffy?
Catherine says, and I have a sneaking suspicion that she's laughing at me. Everyone's gone. It's just me in my flat. Obviously, I've been super chirpy all day and have made sure to give Mo, Gertie and Kay no indication that moving into Leon's flat is at all weird or emotional. But it is a bit weird. And I feel like crying again. I look at my lovely tie-dye blanket lying across the foot of the bed, and all I can think is that it really clashes with Leon's duvet cover, which has manly black and grey stripes, and that there's nothing I can do about that because this is as much Leon's bed as mine, whoever this Leon man is, and that his semi-naked or possibly fully naked body sleeps underneath that duvet. I hadn't really confronted the logistics of the bed situation until this moment, and now that I'm doing it, I'm not enjoying the experience. My phone buzzes. It's Kay. I hope moving in all went smoothly. Help yourself to any food from the fridge until you get fully settled and do your own shop. Leon has asked that you please sleep on the left side of the bed. Kay. Kiss, kiss. That's it. I'm crying. This is really bloody weird. Who even is this Leon guy? Why have I not met him yet? I think about ringing him. I have his number from the advert. But it's pretty clear Kay wants to be the one handling things. I sniff, wipe my eyes hard, and wander over to the fridge. It's actually surprisingly full for someone who works long hours. I help myself to raspberry jam and margarine and locate the bread above the toaster. Okay. Hi, Kay. I'm all moved in, thanks. The flat is feeling really cosy. Thanks for confirming re-side of the bed. It's a bit overly formal for discussing who sleeps on the left or right, but I sense Kay would prefer that we don't all get too friendly. I type out a few queries about the flat. Where's the light switch for the outside hall? Can I plug in the TV? That sort of thing. Then, jam on toast in hand, I head back to the bedroom and contemplate whether it will look too passive-aggressive to remake the bed with my own sheets. Surely Leon would have put freshly laundered ones on in the circumstances, but what if he hasn't? Oh, God, now the thought is there. I'm going to have to change them. I yank up his mattress cover with my eyes screwed shut like I'm afraid of seeing something I don't want to. Right. The probably already clean sheets are in the washing machine, my lovely, definitely clean ones are on the bed, and I'm slightly breathless with all the activity. On second look, the room does feel more me than it did when I got here. Yes, the duvet cover is still wrong. I felt changing that would look a bit pointed. And there are weird books on the shelves. None about making your own clothes. I'll soon fix that. But with my bits and bobs around the place and my dresses in the wardrobe and... yes, I'll just pull the blanket all the way up to cover the duvet, just for now. Much better. As I'm rearranging the blanket, I notice a black plastic sack sticking out from under the bed.